In our last segment, we talked about the new obedience that God creates in the hearts of believers. But we talked as if the believer is an individual, which of course we are. But that's not all that Melanchthon saw about what it means to be human. He also saw that from Genesis 2 on, it's quite clear that God has made us to live in community. How does the Augsburg Confession treat the community of Christians?
Well, at this point, we begin moving into that section of the Augsburg Confession that deals with what you might call the doctrine of the church. In fact, I think articles 7 through 16, in fact, deal with the church. 7 through 15 deal with the church proper, and then Article 16 deals with the relationship of the church or Christians to the world around them. Now, in Article 7, which probably should be taken with Article 8. Article 8, some think, was an appendix to Article 7. In Article 7 on the church, we have what some scholars have suggested is the first dogmatic or creedal definition of the church within the Christian tradition. Now, you may remember that in the Apostles' Creed and Nicene Creed, we confess that we believe that the church exists, but it doesn't describe the nature of that church, or nor does it define what is the church. So Melanchthon opens in this article first by indicating as an article of faith that there is and will remain for all times one holy Christian church. In other words, this reminds us that the church is not our church. The church belongs to the Lord, and whether any particular denomination such as Lutheranism or Methodism or the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod survives is in some ways immaterial. The Lord will see to it that his church does survive wherever it is found within the world. Now at this point then, he moves on to describe or to define the nature of the church. And here we can see that his definition of the church flows directly out of his understanding of justification. To put it another way, that which justifies us, that which brings us into a new relationship with God is the very thing that brings us into the church. And so here, Melanchthon defines the church as a gathering, a community of believers gathered around word and sacrament. Now I'd like to just unpack that a little bit. A gathering or a community is one of, I think, Luther's favorite expressions in the explanation, the third article of the Creed in the Catechism. We saw that the Holy Spirit calls, gathers, enlightens, and sanctifies the whole Christian church on earth. And in some ways, that runs counter to an American understanding of the church. As Americans, we tend to be joiners. We tend to be volunteers. And so we are accustomed to thinking of the church as something that we shop around for and something that we then join. Well, the point here is that just as I do not establish my relationship with God, I do not join the church. As the Holy Spirit creates faith in me, so the Holy Spirit gathers me into the church. Now, how does the Holy Spirit gather me into the church? In the very same way that he brought me to faith. And so in Article 5, when we dealt with how do we acquire such faith, the Holy Spirit creates that faith through word and sacrament. So now in Article 7, how are we gathered into the church? By the proclaimed word and the administered sacraments, or the sacraments that are delivered to us. So the church is a gathering of believers, or the church is believers who are gathered around that activity of proclaiming the word and that activity of baptizing and distributing the Lord's body and blood.
So in a sense, justification, means of grace, and even new obedience all fit together as a kind of framework within which the church is understood as the community of God's people.
Very much so. And the church emphasizes that justification isn't a purely individualistic event. That at the same time I become a child of God in justification, I also become a brother or sister of many other siblings.
Mm-hmm. With the obligations and the joys of having those siblings. Now, that seems pretty obvious to me. Why did Melanchthon have to make this point? What was he arguing against, if anything, in the understanding of the church at his time?
Well, at that point, we start moving into the next section of Article 7, where he speaks about the unity of the church. Mm-hmm. And one of the charges against which the Lutherans had to defend themselves is that by their teaching, by the reforms and practices that they had made, was the criticism that they were introducing a schism within the church. Or, to put it more bluntly, that they had separated themselves from the church and were no longer in the church. Mm-hmm. Now, the most common way of thinking about the church in Melanchthon's day was probably to think of the church a little more geographically or physically. And what I mean by that is this. You're in the church if you are under the care or under the jurisdiction of a bishop. You are a member of the church if you are observing the practices and the traditions of the church. So now, if all of a sudden you are no longer following those practices, you are no longer being obedient, in a sense, to the bishops and the traditions that they prescribe, then you have separated yourselves from the church and are no longer in the church. So, in order to address that, Melanchthon has to make the case as to what it is that constitutes membership in the church. In other words, does following the laws, rules, and regulations of the church make me a member, or is it something else?
That's kind of the idea that we would have as Americans. If you don't keep the laws and pay your dues, you're not really in.
That is right. And I suspect even in our own congregations, we may be tempted to define members or to categorize members by whether or not they're good members or not. And those good members are those who are maybe constantly volunteering to help out in various aspects of the church life. So Melanchthon was able to say, no, we have not left the church. We have not caused a schism within the church because the church is a community of believers around word and sacrament. And when you look at our churches, you can see that the gospel is proclaimed purely. You can see that the sacraments are administered in accordance with the institution of Christ. Where those things occur, there the church exists, and hence the church exists among us as well.
So it's not necessary for the true unity of the church that uniform ceremonies instituted by human beings be observed everywhere, I'm quoting.
That's right. And in Rome's defense, one could argue that they had worked very hard for several centuries to unify the church, particularly in its liturgy and worship and practices, to bring sort of to bring that unity into expression through its uniformity of practices, especially when you're dealing with a church spread across a variety of cultures and languages. This was probably felt to be somewhat important.
And in view of the challenges that unity had from a reformer like John Huss in Bohemia, or John Wycliffe in England, or countless other smaller reform movements.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think Melanchthon denies the value of those external expressions of our unity. It's just that those external expressions do not define or constitute the very nature of the church at its core.
Instead, he turns to Ephesians 4, what unifies us in one body under one spirit is a common hope of our calling, a common Lord, a common faith, the common baptism that God gives us.
Yes. So, where you had just mentioned that it's not necessary to observe uniformly all of these traditions, he then balances that, at least in the Latin side of the text, by saying it is sufficient. It is enough to agree on the gospel proclaimed harmoniously. Mm-hmm. It is enough to agree on the administration of the sacraments in accordance with that gospel. Now, at this point, we move into a very interesting history of the interpretation of this particular article.
Mm-hmm.
For the reason that throughout Lutheran history, particularly I would say here in America, there has been an ongoing debate as to what this article means for how we engage in ecumenical conversations or how we go about achieving external unity with one another.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about the many different synods or different Lutheran church bodies, we have the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod, we have the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod, we have the Evangelical Lutheran Synod, we have the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and in years gone by, there were many more than that. And so the question always arose, is this an article that provides a basis for unity? And here we have developed two different interpretations within Lutheranism. There are those who would argue, well, given that we agree in the gospel, Article 4 on justification, and if we agree on baptism and the Lord's Supper, that is sufficient agreement to establish altar and pulpit fellowship between two Lutheran church bodies. That probably has been more part of the tradition of the Evangelical Lutheran Church than our own. In our own tradition, we have tended to focus more upon those adverbs, the purely preached gospel, or the rightly administered sacraments, in which case our tradition has tended to argue that we must agree on the gospel in its purity. That is, not just Article 4, but all of the ramifications or connections of that gospel to the articles of the faith. You had mentioned the other day that all the articles of doctrine are like members in a body that's one organic unity, so that if any one part of that body is injured, in a sense, the entire body is injured. Or if one thinks of the gospel as the head of the body, if one part of the body is injured or slashed, or if a leg is broken, it may not kill the body, but it's going to introduce, at the very least, a fever to the head, a headache. It could introduce an infection that affects the whole body. So in our tradition, we have tended to emphasize that for altar and pulpit fellowship, it's important to agree on the entire body of God's teaching and not just one or two members.
But in fact, Melanchthon's point is that God is the one who is in charge of this gathering and collecting of the saints in one place, and that he does that through his gospel, through his word, and he's the one who is actually bringing us together.
Yes. And for that reason, I tend to think that both of those approaches that I just mentioned have an element of truth to them. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure that either one of them really apply to this article. I really do think that this article is dealing with the one holy Christian church on earth. Mm-hmm. And that it's not providing us explicitly or directly with a program for how we achieve altar and pulpit fellowship with other church bodies. So in other words, for the unity of the one holy Christian church, you're absolutely right. It's the gospel, the proclamation of Jesus Christ having died for us, the distribution of Christ's gifts to us in word and sacrament that make us members of the one holy Christian church, gather us into that church. Now, at the same time, we have a responsibility to make sure that that gospel is in fact gospel. Mm-hmm. And this is where I think the other articles of faith come into play. So, when I look at another church body, or I suppose when they look at us, as long as I see that the gospel is there, whether it's reading John 3:16, or when I see baptisms going on, I can readily affirm that the Holy Christian Church exists in that location. In other words, the church exists among the Presbyterians, among the Roman Catholics, and among the Lutherans because of that gospel. At the same time, we have responsibility to each other as church bodies to make sure that that gospel is not hidden, obscured, or covered in any way. The analogy I might use although it's somewhat imperfect, is that we can't look at one another or another church body, or they look at us and say, well, as long as the gospel is there, we don't worry about anything else. That would be sort of like my wife and I sitting at the bedside of one of our sick children. Say my son, when he was younger, had a fever of 104, and we're putting cold compresses on him. And then what do you think would happen if I turned to my wife and I said, well, honey, at least he's still alive.
Yeah.
She'd probably slap me upside the head.
Yep.
Yes, he is alive, but we want him to be healthy,
yeah,
fully functioning. And so while Melanchthon could look at Rome and say, yeah, you know, baptisms have been going on there. Mm-hmm. The church is there. Why is it necessary to bring up all these other things about sin or about justification or about the church or about good works? It is because you don't want infections in the body to ultimately kill the heart or to kill the head. And so while Melanchthon is quite willing in this article to say, yes, the church exists, the one holy Christian church exists even in the midst of Rome, and that one holy Christian church exists among us because baptisms are going and the gospel is there. At the same time, he said, we need to talk so that the gospel is not prevented from accomplishing the Holy Spirit's work. And as a result, he presents in the Augsburg Confession not just three articles on justification, baptism, and Lord's Supper. He presents 28 articles on which he seeks agreement.
Now, you mentioned the appendix in Article 8. It makes a very important point, I think. Can you tell us about that point?
Yeah, the point that it's trying to make is to counter an early church heresy known as Donatism. In the early church, the Donatists were a rigorous group of Christians. And when they saw certain pastors fall away in the persecutions, and then when those persecutions ended, those pastors wanted back in the church, the Donatists said, you guys didn't stand firm. When you administer the sacraments, they're not valid. Nothing's happening when you administer those sacraments. What that implied is that the power of the gospel and the power of the sacraments depended upon the worthiness of the person who was administering them, the person who was delivering them. And so Melanchthon is making the important point that the church has always maintained, no, it doesn't. The gospel and the sacraments depend solely on the power and work of the Holy Spirit, regardless of the worthiness of the pastor. Now, I think this provides some important comfort and encouragement to Christians, because pastors have many flaws, and we frequently hear in the news of pastors' failings or pastors falling into very overt and public sins. Well, even knowing that our pastor is a sinner, that does not affect what we call the efficacy of the sacraments. Mm. The sacraments and the word depend solely upon the power of Christ through the work of the Holy Spirit.
And Melanchthon closes the Augsburg Confession by talking more about the office of bishops, as the article is entitled, what it is that pastors do. But that was just one of several issues of reform that Melanchthon treated. The pastors, of course, are a key part of how God manages and carries on the life and work of his church. And Melanchthon turned to that topic in the very last of the articles, one of a number of articles in the Augsburg Confession that deal with the Wittenberg reforms of the church. We will turn to those articles in our discussion in our next segment.